Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The vote in the United States Senate on the Judiciary Committee today for Alito or against will probably be held. It looks like all the Democrats are going to vote no and all the Republicans are going to vote yes, although time will tell. There are still a few wavering. Once again, put out the phone number, toll-free, 888-355-3588, toll-free to Congress. If that one doesn't work, try another one, 888-818-6641, 888-818-6641. And, of course, the main phone number, 202-225-3121. If you've got, Vonage or whatever, you get free long-distance phone calls. That is the actual direct line, is 202-225-3121. A lot in the news today, the spy scandal continuing, George Bush on his PR campaign trying to clean it up, a general from the NSA doesn't understand the Fourth Amendment, thousands, tens of thousands expected at a leftist forum in Venezuela, in Caracas. It just goes on and on, and we're going to get to these things step by step as we go through the program here and through the day today. Just an awful lot. Also, just to let you know, our phone number, area code, is toll-free, 866-440-8466. And if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi, you can get there by going to tomhartman.com. However you spell it will get you there. It is T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's. We have the misspellings as well, hopefully. And just click the link that says live chat, and it'll get you into there. We also have an interview with Howard Dean that we're going to get to a little later on the program as well. That Howard Dean and I had a conversation yesterday in which he said some pretty startling things, and I think are really worthy of comment. In my mind, though, I think one of the largest stories on an ongoing basis has to do with the real conservative agenda. And it's so important that we understand what the real conservative agenda is. What is it that the cons are really up to? And the real conservative agenda is, pure and simple, an economic one. The economic royalists, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt referred to them, the economic royalists, and these guys, after World War II, in 1946, 1947, Harry, in the election of 46, the Republicans took the House and Senate, and Harry Truman tried to push through a national health care program. And the Republicans in the House and Senate said no, and they wouldn't allow it to happen. They pushed through legislation, the Taft-Hartley Act, that made it harder for unions to organize in states, that allowed states to basically opt out of the 1935 Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Act and some parts of it that created union shops. And Truman vetoed it, and they overrode his veto. So Harry Truman, looking at this situation, said, I believe that if we have the fundamental philosophy, that an economy serves society, which has been the liberal philosophy since the founding of this country. It was the philosophy of Thomas Jefferson. It was the philosophy of James Madison. It was the philosophy of certainly of Thomas Paine. He was one of its most eloquent spokespeople. You read his book, The Rights of Man. If we have the philosophy that an economy serves the society in which it exists, that first come the people, and then after the people come the activity of the people, whether that activity is commercial or whatever it may be, and if people want to engage in business, if they want to do business, it's a wonderful thing. We're all in favor of that. I've started a bunch of businesses myself. This radio show is a business. You're listening to this program on a radio station that's a business. We're all in favor of businesses. You will hear commercials from businesses. We'd like you to patronize them. It helps the business of it. But when businesses behave in a way that is toxic to we the people, that is destructive to we the people, and we the people have an obligation to say enough already. And in fact, because we define the rules of the game of business, we define what that infrastructure is going to be like. You know, in order to create a business, you have to go to the Secretary of State and incorporate, or if you're going to do a sole proprietorship, file DBA papers, doing business as, you know, Joe Blow doing business as Acme Widget Incorporated, or it would be incorporated if it was DBA, but you get the point. Because businesses have to be created by the permission of the state, and because they use the resources of the state, we say, you know, if you're going to do business, then you got to play by rules that are going to help society. And Harry Truman looked at the situation and he said, you know, I really believe that having businesses play by the rule, play by rules that say, for example, a strong unionized workforce is a good thing. If we had a lot of unionized workers in the mines, for example, we wouldn't be having mine disasters. Because who's going to be the first, what are the first pair of eyes that are looking around in a mine looking for problems? The workers themselves. If you had true democracy in the workplace, also known as a union, then you'd, number one. Number two, he said, let's have national health care. Number three, let's protect our domestic industries. We had tariffs that we said, you know, hey, if you want to manufacture a pair of tennis shoes in Taiwan, that's cool. But if there's a dollar's worth of labor in that shoes here and there's 10 cents worth of labor in that shoes in Taiwan, then when you import them, you have to pay a 90-cent tax. It's called a tariff. And in fact, that had been so successful that tariffs on imported goods and in some cases on goods in state in commerce between the states, in particular alcohol and tobacco. But in any case, tariffs were the only way that our government was funded at a federal level. The federal government was solely funded by tariffs from its founding in 1787 all the way up until basically the Civil War for all practical purposes, and all the way up to World War I, fully at least a third of our funding of the federal government was from tariffs. And Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush, those four guys basically ripped that whole system apart, tore it up, threw it in the wastebasket, said, we're going to let multinational corporations run the game. But back to Harry Truman. Harry Truman said, I'm going to prove to you that this is right. Because the conservatives are all saying that this is crazy or it's socialism or something like that. He said, I'm going to prove to you that it's really just democracy. And so he helped the Japanese and the German write into their constitutions strong workplace protections, minimum guaranteed vacations, rules that made it more difficult to discharge employees without cause, a whole series of national health care programs. And guess what happened? Between the mid-1940s, when these constitutions were put into place and these rules went into effect, and now these have become the most powerful economies in the world, or among the most powerful economies in the world. So the cons come into power in the United States in 1980, and when they come into power, we are the biggest creditor nation in the world. More people owe us money than any other country in the world. Everybody owes us money. We are the wealthiest nation in the world. We have the strongest domestic industries. We have strong labor unions. Things are going well. And Reagan says, no, this is socialism. We're going to do away with it. And so he starts taking it apart. And if you pick up a copy of today's Wall Street Journal, you will see a graph on there that shows how when Reagan started slashing taxes from 70%, the top marginal rate for people making millions and millions of dollars a year, from 70% down to in the high 20s, when he started slashing taxes, or in the 30s, as I recall, and he didn't cut government spending, he actually increased government spending, boom, suddenly the country was in debt. It wasn't until Bill Clinton came along and said, okay, we're going to raise taxes and actually reduce the size of government, which Bill Clinton actually did, that we went net positive. It's right there, the graph in the Wall Street Journal. So anyhow, the cons have been totally discredited. 25 years of conservative economic policy in the United States, and none of it has worked. What we're seeing is the wiping out of the American middle class because these trade policies are nuts, and our domestic policies don't work. So now we look at Baghdad. This was in the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday, an article by Charles Levison, Chronicle Foreign Service, San Francisco Chronicle Foreign Service. And he starts out with the story of Hadir Gassem in Baghdad's Amil district, having to remind housewives that tomatoes no longer cost 350 dinars, 23 cents. It's an extra 150 dinars. He says, since 2003, the United States has been pushing for rapid free market reforms in Iraq. The conservatives in our government, the true believers, The cons and the neocons, they believe that this is going to solve everything. The free market, right? Food rations that used to help an estimated 8 million Iraqis live on less than a dollar a day, they've been cut by 25%. Tariffs on imports have been cut right across the board, allowing cheap goods to pour in from China. I'm quoting now from the article in the San Francisco Chronicle. And driving Iraqi manufacturers out of business. They're just plain old flat out of business. And you wonder why the Iraqis are upset with us. I'm going to share a little bit more from this with you, and then this piece in the Tribune out of Decatur about, you know, we'll work for less, what they're up to. And then we're going to get into Howard Dean and the head of the NSA displaying a breathtaking ignorance of the Fourth Amendment, the former head of the NSA. All that in just a minute. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss.
Indeed, welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Glad to have you back with us. 21 minutes past the hour. This piece by Charles Levison, he's the San Francisco Chronicle Foreign Service writer. An absolutely brilliant piece. He traveled around Iraq and just said, you know, what's going on? As I pointed out, back in the 40s, after Roosevelt had died and his vice president, Harry Truman, was president and then got elected, Truman said, okay, if the conservatives here in the United States won't let me produce a growing and vibrant economy for the middle class in the United States, at least I can do it for Germany and Japan. And he did. And so you go back to the Project for New American Century and the writings of people like Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl, and they're pretty unambiguous about this. They actually write about this in a lot of places, that if they get power in Iraq, if they can take control of Iraq, they'll turn it into a test tube, a petri dish for democracy, for a free economy, for the wonders of the free market. And sure enough, that's what they did. When they took over Iraq, they changed the rules of the game. They deleted the tariffs. They said there's no more import tariffs. They said that a corporation can hire anybody from anywhere. That, you know, cheap labor can come pouring in. No such thing as illegal immigration. You can just bring in people from Sri Lanka or Pakistan to work for even less than Iraqis will work for. And Iraqis will work pretty damn cheap compared to, you know, when you're paying with U.S. dollars. Bangladeshis will work even cheaper. And so what we have now in Iraq, this from this just brilliant piece by Charles Levison, Ordinary Iraqis Feel the Pinch of Free Market Reforms. Subtitle, Grocery Prices Jump Has Cost a Gasoline Soars Threefold. Tariffs on imports have been cut across the board, allowing cheap goods to pour in from China and driving Iraqi manufacturers out of business. A 2003 foreign investment law continues to anger Iraqi businessmen who say it is squeezing them out of the reconstruction boom. Now, this is where it gets really fascinating. We have sent billions of dollars over there. My recollection is 18 point something billion dollars specifically earmarked for reconstruction. Now, Iraq knows how to build Iraq. They've already done it before. There are palaces, there are office buildings, there are schools, there are shopping centers, there's infrastructure. They know how to build everything from a military base on down to a corner store. They know how to build houses. I mean, Iraq was sort of the Paris of the Middle East for a long time, you know, up until 91. And now, things have changed. On the streets of Baghdad, skepticism about the government's economic policies is easy to come by. At a gas station on Damascus Street, Ahmed Mohammed, called the Tiger by a U.S. Army colonel for whom he translates, huddled, bleary-eyed inside his battered 86 Volkswagen. He's been waiting in line for gas since 3:30 a.m. It's now going on noon. After 8 hours in line, he's facing a gas tab 3 times higher than he'd been accustomed to. There's a factory, the Agras factory. This is just a local company. It's called, you know, AGRAS, Agras Clothing Company. They had 600 seamstresses working there. Why? Because Iraq had laws just like the United States had until Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, Clinton in particular, got rid of them. Laws that said, you know, if you want to make clothes in Bangladesh, that's cool. You can bring them into Iraq, but you're going to have to pay an import tariff so that they to level the playing field so that our seamstresses in Iraq are making, you know, a decent living and not having to compete with somebody who's willing to work for 10 cents an hour because ours will work for 40 cents an hour or whatever it is, right? At the Agras Clothing Factory, 600 seamstresses have lost their jobs since the U.S. occupation slash tariffs in 2003. Unable to compete with the flood of cheap clothes from Asia, Agras turned to importing ready-made clothes from China and whittled its workforce down to a dozen accountants. The owner of Agras, Thamir El-Amari, says, I've adapted. I've changed my ways. Now I design the clothes, send the designs to China, and import the finished products. Fine example of a successful entrepreneur adapting to the global free market, right? It's just exactly what Thomas Friedman says should happen. But the nearly 600 workers he had to dismiss, not so pleased. He said, many of those workers were supporting entire families. An owner of one of the largest construction companies in Iraq, his name is Raghib Blybel, excuse me. He heads the Iraq Businessmen's Union. He said neither he nor any of the organization's 4,400 members, this is the equivalent of the Iraqi Chamber of Commerce, the Iraq Businessmen's Union, not one of their 4,400 members has yet won one single reconstruction contract, thanks largely to a U.S.-enacted investment law that gave foreign companies free rein in Iraq. He says the Iraqi companies don't have the ability to compete. We want foreign companies to be required to partner with Iraqi companies so that Iraqi companies can benefit too, which, by the way, is how it is, for example, in Japan or China. Many of the foreign firms working on reconstruction projects rely on cheap labor from impoverished countries such as Pakistan, the Philippines, and even Sierra Leone. The unemployment rate is 28%. And you wonder why young men who are unemployed are picking up guns and turning them on us. Because we did to them what Reagan, Bush, Clinton with his international policies, and George W. are trying to do to us. And said, you know, sorry guys, it's only for the rich now. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Moving down the highway, you can hear the engine humming. Coming down the byway, you can feel it motor running.
It's your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. 34 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Yesterday, George W. Bush was doing his sales pitch, right? I mean, he's doing a sales pitch for the NSA spying thing so that he's saying, you know, well, yeah, I can spy on you and I don't need a warrant. And we're going to get into that in the next hour of the program and in some more detail. I have just some shocking audio tape to share with you on that. But in the course of it, you know, he decided to take a few questions from this hand-picked, hand-selected, well-vetted, totally sanitized audience. And a young woman stood up and actually had the audacity to point out that in the budget that the Bush administration proposed and was passed by Congress, education got slashed by billions of dollars. And Bush either didn't know or decided to lie about it and call it a reform instead of a slash. Here we go. This is it.
Sorry, my name is Tiffany Cooper. I'm a sophomore here at Kansas State. And I was just wanting to get your comments about education. Recently, $12.7 billion was cut from education. And I was just wondering, how is that supposed to help our futures?
Education budget was cut. Say it again. What was cut?
$12.7 billion was cut from education, and I just want to know, how is that supposed to help our
futures? At the federal level?
Yes.
We don't think we've actually, for higher education? Student loans?
Yes, student loans.
Actually, I think what we did was reform the student loan program. We're not cutting money out of it. In other words, people aren't going to be cut off the program. We're just making sure it works better.
Yeah. The way it works better is that if you get a student loan now, you have to pay an additional $5,600 for over the course, the average student over the course of an education. And the number of people qualifying will be reduced, But, Bush couldn't quite... Well, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's just assume he doesn't know what his own government is doing. We spoke with Howard Dean yesterday. Here's our interview with Howard Dean. Hey, Governor Dean.
Yes, sir.
Great to have you on.
It's good to be on.
Thank you. With all the perception of corruption in Washington, D.C., and certainly the Republican Abramoff corruption that's going on, the reality of it at many levels, do you think it's now time to look at public financing or fundings?
Absolutely. That's why there's such corruption. It's all mostly about campaign money and then doing things as favors. And if you got the money out of it, it would be great. And, this is the Republicans always attack this because, of course, they get the most money out of the special interests. But the truth is the public will do this. The public voted for clean elections in Arizona, which is not noted to be a liberal state. And it's probably the best system in the country. And they have an incumbent governor that won on that system for the first term. So public financing of campaigns is the right way to go. It'll get the dirty money out of politics, and we desperately need to do it.
Great. Have any Democrats been involved with the Abramoff case? And if not, why haven't other members of the Democratic Party been out in front in the media like you were a week or so ago with Wolf Blitzer saying over and over and over again that this is a Republican scandal?
Well, they're working on that. But, one of the problems in Washington is that people are not risk takers. They're rapid adapters, and so they tend not to get out in front. We need to do that. Not one dime of money, Jack Abramoff's money, has ever gone to a Democrat in this cycle of corruption here. And not one, there's no evidence whatsoever that any money has ever been directed by Abramoff to go to a Democrat. So this business of roping in Reid and Dorgan and all that stuff, it's just not true. There's no evidence that had anything to do with Abramoff. And it's just, frankly, it's laziness on the part of the media. The RNC is spinning it that way, which you'd expect, but the media is really just, they have no business printing that stuff because the fact is there's nothing behind it.
Governor Dean, do you agree with Al Gore that President Bush's warrantless wiretaps are crimes? And if so, and the Democrats take power in 2006 in the House, the Senate, or both, would you push for impeachment?
Well, I think the impeachment stuff is a technical argument. And let me explain to you what I mean. First of all, of course, the Republicans aren't going to impeach anybody. But if the question is if we take power, I would be careful of this. I think the president clearly broken the law. The question is, A, is it an impeachable offense? I think there probably are some impeachable offenses that he's committed. I'm not sure this is one of them. And B, what are the political ramifications of running impeachment? I know there are a lot of Democrats who would like to impeach the president because they're so angry with him, but let's not forget when Bill Clinton was impeached, his numbers went up. So the American people has a very strong fairness quotient. I think before we got to anything like that, you'd have to build a tremendous public case for it, and I don't think we're there at this particular time. It's also a pretty hypothetical question. Let's win the majorities back first, not so we can impeach the president, but so we can have an honest government again and so we can make improvements in American lives again.
And perhaps some investigations?
Well, we certainly want to do that. I mean, one of the great attractions of winning back the House and the Senate is that Henry Waxman, who's one of the smartest people I know in Congress, will then be able to investigate all the wrongdoing that's gone on. And there's been, as we know, an enormous amount of wrongdoing.
Governor Dean, in a democracy, democracy is all about the commons, and probably the most important part of the commons is our vote itself. I'm wondering why it has been allowed to have been privatized and why more Democrats aren't speaking out against private corporations running our vote, putting together ballot lists, voter lists, and telling us how we voted after we play with their machines.
I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think it's a terrible mistake. The election machines clearly have a significant problem with them. They were not served well when the public can't have confidence in their machines. And this is not some internet theory that we all have to worry about the election machines. The General Accounting Office, which is a nonpartisan group, has said that these election machines cannot be relied on. So this is a huge issue. When people start losing confidence in the votes and whether they're counted, then American democracy is in real trouble. People do speak out about this, but I think they need to do it more firmly than we have so far.
Governor Dean, what in your mind is the most important message that you have for our listeners today?
And the most important message is if you want a real change, vote for a Democrat. And here's what you'll get. One, honesty and integrity back in government again. Two, a strong national defense, which is based on telling the truth to our citizens and our soldiers and our allies. Three, a health care system that works for everybody. Four, just like 36 other countries have. Four, American jobs that will stay in America using energy independence as a new industry to create millions of jobs. And five, a strong public education so we can have opportunity and optimism again. That's a pretty good thing to get, and that's what we'll deliver. Certainly the president is incapable of such a thing.
That sounds marvelous. Governor Dean, you mentioned that you weren't sure that the wiretaps, the warrantless wiretaps, would rise to the level of being an impeachable crime. I'm wondering, but you said other things may. I'm wondering what those other things might be in your
mind. I think we're going to find that the president has engaged in worse things than this in some ways. I think that... We know, for example, that the information that is used to determine whether certain drugs should come to the market or not has been corrupted by the White House. They've been told to find certain things that, in fact, they haven't. The science doesn't indicate.
Are you talking about Plan B, or are you talking about more general pharmaceuticals?
Plan B for one, but there's other things as well. We know, for example, that the administration lied to Congress about. How the Medicare bill was going to work and how much it was going to cost. We know for a fact that civil rights attorneys in the Justice Department were routinely overruled regarding civil rights issues and voting issues. So we find here that there really is a pattern of corruption in this administration, which goes beyond simply the wiretapping. And I think we need. In order to really do a good job, I think we need to thoroughly investigate what the grounds might be.
Okay. And Governor Howard Dean, thank you so much for the time with us. I really appreciate it. You're doing a great job, sir.
My great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That Governor Howard Dean, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, our phone number 866-440-8466, and Dave in Santa Ana, California on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
How's
it
doing today?
Great, great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Well, I got a problem with the Democrats here. We got Howard Dean here. He's telling us that they're not interested in impeaching Bush. We got the rest.
No, he didn't say that. He said first let's investigate it. Well, the one thing where I disagree with him, he pointed out that when Clinton was being impeached, his popularity went up. I think that's because the American people have a sense of fairness, and they felt that, you know, having sex in the White House is not something for which a president should be impeached. It's something that probably half the presidents in history did.
If I go out and knock over a liquor store, I'm going to go to jail whether it's politically correct or not.
Yeah,
no matter what my excuse is.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other thing, you know, they're not going to stand up on Alito. Okay, what are these guys?
Well, let's, you know, Dave, they're not going to stand up on Alito unless enough of us contact them and say stand up on Alito, because these guys.
I called 40 different senators in the past week and a half. Okay, they have gotten thousands and thousands of calls. People are screaming every place I hear that the Democrats are nothing but a bunch of gutless cowards, and all they're doing is proving it.
Well, we'll see. I sure hope you're wrong, Dave, and if you're right, then we need to take them to task and hold them responsible for it.
Well, I am. I'm voting Green Party next election.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did that in 2000. What can I say? I can't criticize you for it, but I think it's, you know, I would prefer to hear you say, I am, and I'm going to show up at the next Democratic County meeting and raise hell and help take over the party, because that's what I think should be done, frankly. I think I made a big mistake in 2000, and I'll be the first to tell you that when I voted for Ralph Nader, even though I lived in Vermont, which was a safe state, which was my rationalization. In any case, it's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I got friends with low wages. Now one thing I've learned, when Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights, stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're a follower of the pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, I got friends like that, too. I'll bet you do, too. 51 minutes past the hour, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Alan in Arlington, Texas. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program. Alan?
Yeah. Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi. What's up?
Just kind of a question, and just kind of need to set it up briefly. Basically, the arguments that I have with my conservative friends, I waste them on recent economic trends as they relate to the middle class.
Sure.
The only thing they come back with, and I kind of need some ammo, I guess, because I wasn't politically aware at this time, what they come back with is, well, you know, Reagan took over, inflation was high, interest rates were high, supply-side economics fixed all of that and created all the high-tech jobs, and that's why we had good economics in the 90s. We could have had a monkey in the office, Clinton gets no credit, and...
No, it's absolute silliness. First of all, yeah, the inflation was high and the economy was hitting a rough patch during Jimmy Carter's administration. And the reason why was because both a Democrat, Lyndon Johnson, and a Republican, Richard Nixon, decided to have a war on the cheap. They decided to borrow for the Vietnam War and tried to have social spending and a war at the same time. Didn't work. We're doing the same. We're repeating that mistake. And, you know, the next generation, the next couple of presidents are going to inherit a real mess, as Jimmy Carter did when he came into office. Carter started pulling it back together. They started raising interest rates to try and wring the inflation out of the economy that had been brought about by that war, which was very painful for a lot of Americans. And Ronald Reagan got the benefit of that. Ronald Reagan then slashed taxes and threw the government into deficit, and they had to begin borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund in order to keep the government running from day to day. It was Reagan who started that, and in 82. And not only that, he then had to start borrowing from the rest of the world to the point that Ronald Reagan ran up more debt in his 8 years as president than every president from George Washington until Ronald Reagan combined. When you consider the cost of fighting World War II, which was borrowed money, World War I, which was borrowed money, the Spanish-American War, which was borrowed money, the Civil War, which was borrowed money, and the Revolutionary War, and the War of 1812, all of them combined, Ronald Reagan ran up more debt than all of them combined. Now, and that debt, by the way, you and I are paying $160 billion this year in interest on the just on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up. Now, forget the debt that George W. ran up, too. That's another $200 billion in interest that we're going to pay this year. And
you know, the interesting thing is that I haven't heard a retort really from someone else, but that was my retort.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes perfect sense.
The Vietnam War, I'm like, guys, I don't really know. I wasn't aware. I said, but it seems like we had a war that was like 17, 10 years long that we spent, as I understand, $600 billion on.
Yeah, we wasted an enormous amount of money.
And we're doing the same thing again.
You're absolutely right.
You can't blame this on Jimmy Carter when he took over in 77.
You're absolutely right, Alan. And the other point that you want to make to them is, and listen, what Reagan did and what George W. Bush are doing is they ran, George W. Bush right now is borrowing $2 billion a day, most of it from overseas, to keep this economy afloat. I'm telling you, you give me a credit card where I've got just personally, you give me a credit card with $1 million a year credit line on it, and I don't have to pay that back, I'll show you what it looks like to live large.
That's what we're doing. We're doing whatever, the median income's down, real wages are down, economic growth up because we're basically doing this on the float.
That's right. That's exactly right. You are absolutely right, Alan. Alan, I got to move along, but well said. I appreciate it. John on the line. I don't have a city for you, John. Where are you?
I'm around Scranton, PA.
Ah, great. Hey,
yeah.
What's
I'm
up?
A frequent caller, moderate to liberal. I generally agree with you, but the thing on tariffs, because, economics gets really, really hazy. In our current context right now, wouldn't tariffs kind of be painful in the short run and not really solve any problems, kind of like the Hawley Smoot tariff back under Hoover, and I believe James A. Garfield passed one in between the Grover-Cleveland years that also caused an increase in prices without matching wages. Because right now, in our context, if we were to increase tariffs, which I think the China problem is more a monetary problem, if they would just get off of their...
No, you've been drinking the Kool-Aid, John.
No.
If China doubled the value of the yuan tomorrow,
exactly.
If they doubled the value of the yuan, then that $140 Christmas tree that you bought, you know, 6-foot-tall, $140 Christmas tree that people buy that literally costs $4 to bring into the United States would cost $8 to come into the United States. That's not going to solve anything.
But then on another scale, when you talk about people bringing in componentry who are doing their jobs over here, who have American jobs here, when you're putting tariffs on everything, isn't that also going to increase the cost of doing business?
Yes, it is,
American?
But it's also going to create American jobs. You're going to see people going from $6 and $7 an hour jobs to $20 and $30 an hour jobs back to the way it was. All I'm suggesting is that we go back to the way it was from 1787 up until basically Bill Clinton blew the whole thing apart. And the whole argument about Smoot-Hawley, people say Smoot-Hawley, you know, exacerbated the Great Depression. Smoot-Hawley was passed by a Republican president, by Herbert Hoover in 1930. And increased tariffs. And, yes, it did trigger a small trade war, as it were. A lot of other countries also started increasing tariffs. The long-term consequence of that, I think, and there's a lot of economists out there who will argue this on both sides, but I think that Smoot-Hawley actually had a positive effect and helped the United States recover from the Great Depression rather than the negative effect. And there is no solid evidence on either side of that one, unfortunately, because, you know, there's no way to test it, right? The bottom line is that if tariffs are used to protect labor and to protect industries, then they work. If they're used as punishment, then no, they don't work. At least the trade wars and you have a mess. And yes, the other answer is probably over the short term there would be some pain, because, you know, it's like any family trying to get back to living within their means. You know, for a while, you got to hold your breath economically. But I think it's a good thing, and I think that that's the way we need to go. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you in a few minutes here. I know we've got a couple of callers who wanted to talk about satellite radio censorship. Apparently a hot topic right now, just as the result of some events that happened this morning or yesterday. And I will share with you my thoughts on that. I have some very specific opinion, the right word? Actually, I have the answer to the whole thing. I'll tell you, you know, why that may happen and, you know, what it's all about. And we'll do that after the next break, and I'll be taking your calls on the topic as well, so just stick around. But first, it's time for our Bioneers segment for the day. Bioneers.com, their website. Pramila Jayapal is the founder and executive director of Hate Free Zone Washington. Pramila, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
Tell us what Hate Free Zone Washington is. You're based in Seattle, Washington, right?
Yeah, we're based in Seattle, Washington, and we're a nonprofit immigrant and civil rights organization. And our mission is to further the fundamental principles of democracy and justice. And we do that primarily with working with immigrant communities and other allies who are looking for ways to ensure that we uphold our Constitution and make sure that we have rights for everyone.
I've seen some conflation of legal immigrants and illegal immigrants in the public mind and in the media, and particularly in, you know, right-wing talk radio and whatnot. I'm assuming that it's the legal immigrants who are, for example, Muslim or African, first generation, who are receiving probably, and South Asians as well, receiving the brunt of the hate crimes and discrimination that we're experiencing right now, and a lot of, you know, the rationale for it is 9/11?
Well, the interesting thing is that we were founded right after 9/11. I started this right after 9/11, and originally it was about individual discrimination against other individuals. And many of those folks were, as you noted, Muslim, South Asian, East African, a lot of Arab. But what we found is that in the past, really the years since September 11th, the past 4 years, the debate on immigration and national security have been combined. And so we work with undocumented people of all, because there are many undocumented Asians, for example. I think people aren't aware of it. But part of the reason for that is that we've realized that our immigration system is completely broken. And combining it with national security, I think, is a big mistake on our part, because we're not able to find a fix for the immigration system by looking at really what are the problems in immigration. And there are portions of it that overlap with national security, but those are two different issues. And we think that there's consensus around the fact that the immigration system is broken. We need to, I think, determine how and in what areas do we also look at national security as part of that effort.
We're talking with Pramila Jayapal. Am I pronouncing that right?
Jayapal, right.
Jayapal,
close.
Thank you.
Right.
Also the author of a book, Pilgrimage to India, A Woman Revisits Her Homeland. My take on the whole illegal immigration thing is that, I mean, we have 10 to 11 illegal immigrants in the United States, most of them working, and that conservatives understand that there's a law of supply and demand. If they can increase the supply of labor, they can drive down the price of labor, and it's and therefore these policies that they've been pursuing that actually encourage illegal immigration, on the one hand, are driving down the cost of labor in the United States, and on the other hand, are supporting the corrupt oligarchy in Mexico and several other, Central and Southern American countries. And that doesn't serve anybody. It doesn't serve us. It doesn't serve those countries. It doesn't serve democracy. It doesn't serve anybody. Am I missing something?
No, I think that's right. I think the question is, so what do we do about that? What we're looking to do is make sure
that... Yeah, building a wall is silly. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah, building a wall. I mean, we've done that, Tom. We've done that before, and we spent a lot of money on it, and it hasn't helped. And there are lots of studies that show that just increasing security along the border doesn't help either, because people are, as you pointed out, this is not just about what's happening here. It's also about what is the United States' role in other countries. And if we're looking at border issues and economic issues, we've got to look at what are the forces that drive people to come here. If we want to really address immigration, I think we not only need to have domestic immigration policy that makes sense, but we also need to look at what's our foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
How are we dealing with issues like NAFTA and CAFTA, and what impact do those have on whether or not people, try to come here to seek a better life.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's really interesting, because you've pointed out, I think, the hypocrisy of a lot of folks who say, well, we don't want illegal immigrants here. But if you ask them if they're willing to pay higher wages, if you ask them if they're willing to give workers benefits, if you ask them, well, let's make all these folks legal so that we don't have undocumented workers anymore, and then let's have a policy where, an immigration policy, where people really have the right to pursue a path to citizenship, a legal path to citizenship. Many of those same people who don't want to see undocumented workers here will also say they don't want to see a reform of the system.
Why?
I think that there's, right now, I think in a lot of our work we see this mentality of fear, this mentality of scarcity, and us versus them mentality, and also, frankly, in many parts of the anti-immigrant movement, a lot of racism. And if you look at people who say, for example, well, we are at the highest rates of immigration ever in the nation's history, that's not true. It was in 1913 that was the issue. But
and in fact, my grandfather and grandmother came over here in 1917, in the tail end of that.
That's right. But they were really at the height of the, of the immigration.
That was when Ellis Island was just cranking them through so badly that, my name is not the same name my grandfather had, because they were passing them through so fast they screwed it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that many people have those experiences, and so they know that this is the history of America. But most of the people came, I'm assuming, I haven't actually, looked at this, but I think the number is somewhere around 80% of the folks who came over were Caucasian. It might be higher than that.
Yeah.
They were coming primarily from Europe. That number has flipped. So 80% now are coming from Africa, Asia, other parts, Latin America. And so I do think that there's, a huge amount of racism that we don't talk about very often, because it's a controversial subject no matter how you talk about it, but it's true.
Well, it's very real, and I think that, for example, you see these poor guys on TV who are the Minutemen, right? And they're down there on the border, you know, strutting around with their guns. And it's really, in my mind, a tragic sight. They are being exploited by the very conservatives that they think they are part of. You know, and it's exploited basically on the basis of racism and xenophobia. And yet, at the same time, we have to acknowledge that by having an immigration policy that is really a non-policy, at least with regard to illegal immigration,
that
we are supporting this corrupt former Coca-Cola executive, Vicente Fox, and the 36 families, more or less, who basically run Mexico, the oligarchy in Mexico, and many other countries in South and Central America as well. We're supporting them. I mean, 10% of Mexico's GDP is from illegal workers in the United States sending checks home. That's not healthy for us. It's not healthy for Mexico.
No, that's absolutely right. And if you look at what undocumented workers are contributing in the United States, you know, our social security system would probably fall apart without the contributions of both legal and undocumented immigrants. And so
actually, I think that's been exaggerated. They're talking $5 billion a year. I don't buy that. but you know.
Even if you didn't, and this is one of the things, we actually try to stay away from a lot of the numbers because we find that people are able to give numbers for whatever side they happen to be talking
about.
Well,
and so much of this stuff is cash. I mean, there's so much cash business. In every city in America now, there are day labor spots where you can go down and you can pick up illegal day labor. And then, interestingly, I mean, here in Portland, the local paper did a thing on this, and they found that a lot of these folks then, you know, get ripped off. People say, yeah, I'll hire you for $5 an hour, pay you cash. They come out, they do the work for the day, and then they pay them half of what they said. And when people say, hey, wait a minute, what happened to the rest of the money? They say, you know, sue me.
No, that's right. And, you know, what we've said is our comprehensive immigration reform has to include four basic principles. The first one is a path to citizenship so that those undocumented people that are down at the day labor centers are able to become legal in a reasonable way. So it's not that, you know, they would just become a citizen or a resident immediately, but there would be a path. Two, that they would have rights on the job so that, you know, people wouldn't be able to hire them and then say, sorry, we know you're undocumented and you don't have any rights, so we're just not going to pay you. Three, that people would be able to reunite with their families. So if you have refugees, asylees, people who do come over here, are here legally, they would be able to see their family members. Sometimes people wait 10 to 12 years to get a child into the country. And then the fourth one is around civil rights and civil liberties and really making sure, and this is the place where, you know, a lot of our work around detention, deportation, comes up, but making sure that people still have all of the same rights that we guarantee in the Constitution, that we don't start saying, well, these rights are only good for these people, but not these people.
Yeah, well said. Pramila Jayapal. Yeah?
Jayapal, right.
Jayapal, thank you. The founder and director, executive director of Hate Free Zone, Washington. And you don't have a website for this organization?
We do. It's www.hatefreezone.org.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Hatefreezone.org. Thank you so much, Pramila, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good conversation. I appreciate it. 16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started. In here. Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we run rings around the right wing every single day, 5 days a week, 3 hours a day. Welcome back to our program, 21 minutes past the hour. Alan Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Then, after the bottom of the hour, we'll be going to your calls and picking up this issue of censorship of satellite radio and others. And I definitely want to get into what this general who was leading the NSA when George W. Bush said, time to spy on Americans, thought the Fourth Amendment said. We've got the audio. It's going to blow your mind. But Ellen Ratner with us first. Hey, Ellen.
It is pretty amazing, actually, what he said, because he totally gets the Fourth Amendment completely wrong.
Yeah. And well, I'll save it for my listeners for when
you
I play it.
You can save
for
them, it. Yeah. But also today, Attorney General Gonzalez spoke at Georgetown on why we spy. A quarter of the audience stood up, turned their backs. One group actually had black hoods on. like the guy that was tortured at Abu Ghraib.
You're kidding.
No.
Where was this? Where was he speaking?
At Georgetown.
Georgetown University. And so these were university students who did this?
These were university students. And he actually, in his speech, cited that a state of war is not a blank check. He said that the program had been reviewed by NSA lawyers. He cited the President of the United States' constitutional powers. He said that intelligence activities go back to George Washington, who intercepted mail, that telegraphic wiretapping was common in the Civil War. And he said that they take for granted that the president actually has the authority. And then he talked about the Fourth Amendment. I mean, this is where he really went, even though there's been quite a bit of case law, et cetera, on this, that the Fourth Amendment doesn't always require a warrant, and he cited airports, borders, and DUI checkpoints. Now, you know, I mean, that, as you
those
know...
Those are places where there were... Yeah, okay. Excuse me, I interrupted you, as you know.
He basically said that the standards that they applied at the NSA was the reasonable basis to believe that it's essentially the same in terms of Fourth Amendment stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, Fourth Amendment around.
Oh, these guys, they're so far off the wall, it's bizarre. I'm curious if a quarter of the students in the room at Georgetown University stood up, put on black hoods, and turned their back on Gonzalez, what happened? Did they arrest him? Did they hustle him out of the room? Did he respond to it?
It was just a silent protest, and it just went on, and he went on with his speech.
And they just stood there?
Apparently so.
Amazing. Amazing. I hope there's some video of that floating around tonight.
Yeah. Also, this morning, Helen Thomas asked Scott McClellan if the president was planning to ask Congress for the authority to legally eavesdrop on telephone calls, and McClellan said the president has the authority to act within the Constitution to do this to protect American people, and that's exactly what he intends to do. He said that domestic spying was an inaccurate description of the program since one party has to be outside of the United States. Well, they've sort of switched on that several times.
Yeah, and now they're calling it the terrorist surveillance program.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, also, of course, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved the Alito nomination on a party-line vote.
Okay.
But that what's interesting is that Senator Kyle of Arizona is now saying that it's unrealistic to think that one party would put itself at a disadvantage in terms of not taking in consideration political considerations while the other party almost unanimously applies such considerations. So I say to my Democratic
friends... Is that a call for a filibuster?
Well, no. I mean, Kyle is totally against it, but he said, so I say to my Democratic friends, think carefully about what is being done today. The impact will be felt well beyond this nominee. So he's even saying that in them doing a party-line vote, that they're really... they're turning away the red staters.
But he was one of the ones who voted no, or was he not on the committee?
No, Kyle is voted yes. He's a Republican.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
Right.
So you have a Republican. You have a Republican warning the Democrats that if they behave like Republicans, they're going to get trashed.
That's right.
I think I've slipped into that alternate universe I used to read about in Superman comic books, you know, Bizarro World, where everything's upside down and opposite.
Right. Let me just finish with one other, there's quite a bit today, but as you know, there was a march in Cuba today to protest the 5-foot-high news ticker that is now on the American intersection, or it's actually the Swiss intersection, which is the former American embassy in Havana. And Castro gave a speech saying they've turned on the display. How brave the cockroaches are. Little Bush must have sent the order, which is what he calls Bush.
Mm-hmm. Well, he must have.
Now, of course. Of course.
The cockroaches are.
There's really quite a bit going on. And the other thing is, of course, that the human rights group in Switzerland to the European Union did say that the United States outsourced torture, that they flew the detainees to other countries. However, they said at this point there was no tangible proof of the existence of the clandestine centers in Romania.
And they also said that those countries that we were outsourcing, to whom we were outsourcing the torture, knew about it and agreed with it.
And over 100 people, they think.
Yeah, amazing. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks so much for being with
You're
us
welcome.
Today. Great speaking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Indeed, over at Newsmax, the right-wing website, Howard Stern has admitted he's been given certain guidelines for what he can and cannot do on his Sirius satellite radio show. Sirius advertises itself as having no limits, but after the New York Post reported today that Sirius executives are setting boundaries for his show, Stern denied it. See, there you go. That's what happens. You start talking about this kind of stuff, and you get the spaceship sound. Stern denied he's being censored, but conceded, I mean, there are some boundaries. Oddly, Stern then said, I set my own boundaries. At one point, he even told his listeners that the Post story was completely fabricated, only have sidekick Artie Lang interject that he and other staffers have been called into a meeting with executives about the show's content. Then Stern admitted that he had had a meeting with Sirius higher-ups over certain guidelines. So, interesting. I will share with you my thoughts on that as we take a phone call on this thing. Andy in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's going on, Mr. Hartman?
We're alive and kicking.
Real quick, when we're done here, could you put me back on hold so I could hear the rest of your comments?
Sure.
I'm just curious, how can you... Sirius isn't doing the censorship, but there's a... Congress is trying to pass a bill that would allow them to censor pay service such as cable TV and satellite radio.
Well, cable TV is already censored.
I'm sorry?
Cable TV is already censored. If you try and run an X-rated movie on cable TV, in most parts of the country, without it being in a premium channel you have to pay extra for, you're put out of business or you go to jail.
Yeah.
It's already censored.
Then, for example, you're going to censor satellite radio, but then wouldn't you have to censor books and newspapers as well?
Well, books and newspapers are censored right now. There are certain things. It's largely limited to child pornography, but there are some things that you can't publish even here in the United States of America. But here's my take on the censorship of satellite radio and other media. If you think back to cable TV, when cable TV first started getting flack about having off-color content or, you know, whatever you call it, the cable TV industry itself came out and said, we're going to create premium channels where people pay extra, where we will put that content and you're going to have to pay extra for it, and we're going to censor everything else so that the rest of cable TV will be family-friendly. And the excuse was, we're trying to create a family-friendly environment in cable TV. But the reason, in my opinion, was that they had the technology. Once they developed the technology, this didn't come along until the technology came along. For the first couple of years of cable TV, and I remember it well, they didn't have any way to interact with individual users. And it wasn't until cable TV, particularly digital cable TV, came out, it wasn't until cable TV systems got sophisticated enough in their technology that they could ding you for an extra $6 so that you could watch an X-rated movie, that suddenly X-rated movies started becoming available. And, or for that matter, even R-rated content stuff, you know, HBO and stuff like that. And so my take on this is that ultimately, Andy, it's all about the money. That when the satellite TV guys, the satellite radio rather, folks, figure out a way to charge an individual user an extra buck a month or, you know, a year or a day or whatever, to charge an individual user extra, at that point, then they will say, we, in order to prevent being censored by the FCC, we're going to put, you know, Howard Stern or whatever. It would probably be stuff more outrageous than Stern, frankly. We're going to put this into a separate channel. And really, it's all about making extra money.
So, but, I mean, there's a difference then between audio and video.
No, not really.
Well, I'm just saying you're going to...
I mean, there's things I can't say on the air, just like there's things you can't show on TV.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, you're going to censor, like, pornos and stuff, but you got a guy that's just sitting there doing a comedy routine.
I agree with you, Andy,
but you know what I mean?
I do, but I'll tell you, there is audio porn. In fact, the audio porn business in the United States is a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry where people call up 900 numbers and talk to ladies who breathe heavy on the phone with them, by and large women. But, you know, I suppose that there's a service like that for men as well. But the point is that kind of the conspiracy that exists between big business and government is that government says, okay, we're going to clamp down with you know, guidelines or censorship or whatever you want to call it, once private industry has the technology to make extra money on it. It's the same reason Monsanto went to, during the Reagan administration, Monsanto went to George Herbert Walker Bush when he was vice president and personally went to the vice president and said, we want regulations on the genetically modified food industry. Now, at that time, there was no genetically modified food. It didn't exist. Monsanto was in the process of developing it. Why would they say they wanted regulations? Because what the regulation did is it legalized it. It made it possible for them to do it. So if the government comes along, if the FCC comes along, and the satellite radio companies come along, and it's not just satellite radio. I mean, this is cable TV. This is, I expect that we're going to probably, well, already we're seeing this on the Internet. If you want to see real pornography on the Internet, they're saying, hey, it's got to be at a pay-for site, and you got to use a credit card as a way of proving that you're an adult. Really, that's just a way of saying, let's make sure that somebody's making some money on this. It's all about the bucks.
So because I'm 25 and I want to make my own decisions and be an adult and listen to, fart humor, I have to pay extra because somebody is too, childish to turn the radio knob.
Well, yeah, or no. I mean, that's the way it's being spun, Andy. That's the message that everybody's been putting out. But really, the answer is, if you want to listen to fart humor, or if you want to listen to, or for that matter, overtly sexual stuff, or you want to hear, an old Lenny Bruce routine, or the seven, words you can't say, or whatever. If you want to hear that stuff, you're going to have to pay extra, not because somebody can't turn their dial, but because a big corporation that provides that medium can make extra money by selling it to you and use the excuse of decency and censorship as a way to increase their profits.
All right. And one last
I know this is a very cynical viewpoint, as somebody who's on satellite radio, I suppose, it's probably impolitic, but I think it's the case.
Yeah. One last question.
Yeah.
Do you think it's in any way a personal attack? Like a witch hunt, if you would, on Stern himself?
No, I don't think so. I think if I was serious, and obviously I'm not, and I was hiring Howard Stern, I'd want to sit down and have a conversation with him about how far are you going to go on our network? Maybe we're going to have to develop two channels, so that people can avoid it. Or maybe at some, or like I said, if the technology comes along where we can ding people an extra $2 for the X-rated Howard Stern channel, or you can get the R-rated Howard Stern channel normally, then, let's make the extra $2, off a whole bunch of people. I just don't know if they have that technology yet. My guess is they probably do, but because they can determine, if you don't pay your bill, they can cut off your access to the satellite stream. So my guess is that they can figure out a way to charge you a little extra. But and this isn't a slam on Sirius, but XM has got to be working on this. It's just following the cable model.
Yeah.
Okay?
I hope I've answered your question,
and I don't have to put you on hold here.
Okay. Oh, yeah, hour and 15 minutes, man. Can I get a book out of it or something?
Yeah. I appreciate it, Andy. I really do.
I had to try, sir.
Yeah, thanks
well,
a lot.
As a 25-year-old white male, middle class, living in Ohio, you're my voice of reason. I appreciate it, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Andy. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Adam in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Hey, Adam, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
I want to kind of rebut what you were talking about with the technology maybe not being up to par.
Well, I think it's actually there right now. It's just that they haven't rolled it out yet.
Well, it really is. I can make a phone call now and say I don't want Howard's channels.
Oh, you can?
Yeah,
you can block a channel
out,
on Sirius.
You can block out any channel that you want.
Oh, I didn't know that.
On Sirius, I'm not too sure about XM, but I'm sure if Sirius can do it, as well as XM could.
Yeah, well, then they already have the technology to offer premium channels. My guess is it'll just be a matter of time.
I don't feel that, I'm already paying for the service, just as you would, pay for cable, and which cable self-regulates themselves. And satellite will do the same thing, I'm sure of.
Yeah.
But,
well, yeah, and this bill
has been proposed by Senator Ted Stevens.
Yeah.
About historical uses and privacy for the recording companies, movie companies.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's that? If that was law in the early 80s, we wouldn't have a VCR today.
Yeah.
Or TiVos, or iPod, or satellite radio.
Or we might have figured out a way around it. You know, or we might have figured out a way around it, Adam. But you know, basically, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you that a lot of this legislation is anti-technology, and that ain't a good thing. On the other hand, you know, it's always going to be the dollar rules. Adam, I got to move along. I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you, Dave in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. Dave.
My name's Kevin. I cannot believe you just hung up on me without telling me where I can find out this answer.
I just hung up on you.
Hello?
Hello?
Who am I speaking to?
I don't know. Something really strange is going on.
I know.
Is this Dave in Albuquerque?
It sure is.
Is there anybody named Kevin there with you, Dave?
That's what I was told there. I wasn't there for a while.
Oh, is this strange? Alberto Gonzalez has got to be on your line. Or maybe he's on mine. Wow! There it goes. This is wild. Dave, you still there?
I'm here now, yeah.
Okay. We'll
let you go for...
Yeah, we got 20 seconds.
Excuse me?
Go ahead.
No, as far as I'm going to say, the reason what they need to look for when it comes to this spying program is the people in office or CEOs that...
Boy, this is just totally strange. This is just totally strange.
Yeah.
Dave, your line has gone nuts. I'm gonna drop it. It's something very strange going on here. Anyhow, that's my take on it. I think it's just, you know, pretty straightforward. And as Michael Harrison of Talker Magazine yesterday, he was talking about this. He says, if Sirius isn't developing policies on standards and practices, it would be the only company in the world that doesn't have any. That makes sense to me too. I think it's just a reasonable thing. And frankly, you know, I think Howard Stern should have his own boundaries. I have my own internal boundaries. I mean, you know, we all decide. That's how you give character to a show, for that matter. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There's a warm tonight and the moon turning up the tide. When the stars take their ride, she'll be leaving. Where she goes?
I don't know.
I don't know.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, helping you win the water cooler wars with Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you. And time for our voting alerts.
Just a push of a button, just a touch of a screen.
Yes.
Welcome to the future. Come try our voting machine.
There you go. Well, the Alaska Democratic Party says there are major discrepancies in the numbers of the 2004 election. However, the State Division of Elections has denied access to the public records that would verify the election's accuracy. They claim the electronic computer file that contains all the final vote tallies is proprietary information belonging to Diebold Election Systems. That company is the contractor for voting processes in Alaska. Yes, indeed, our voting alert for the day. It's mind-boggling, isn't it? I mean, you know, really and truly mind-boggling. Incredible. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. And Dave in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Tom.
You want to try it again?
Be able to talk to you. Hey, real quick, I just want to go and make a statement as to this government spying program that's going on.
Sure.
What people aren't even thinking about cluing into is, if you remember when this administration first got into office, they were basically in all their speeches and everything they were talking about, they were they sound basically like ex-CEOs, like business people, right?
Right. In fact, they said, we're going to bring you the CEO administration.
Yeah, well, think about it for a second. With this spying program, guess what happens when they can go in and spy in the calls, say, business dealings are going on, say, if business is going to go ahead and, as far as the business is going to split?
Yep.
I mean, they can go up.
What you have identified, Dave, is the essential issue with regard to this administration. George W. Bush and Dick Cheney telling us when they first came into power that they're going to bring us a CEO administration. And what most Americans don't get is that while a union is a democracy, unions elect their leaders, a corporation is not a democracy, it's a kingdom. And George W. Bush telling us right up front, I mean, he was made no bones about it. Back in 2001, as soon as the Supreme Court selected him, he said, we're going to run this country like a company. And I'm going to behave like a CEO because that's, you know, that's my background. I was a CEO. And sure enough, that's what he's doing. Because companies are run like kingdoms. They're not run like democracies. And Dave, looks like we've lost you, but good point. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Tom.
Hey.
Exactly. Good morning. But guess what? In my judgment, it's not going to work in the long run, maybe the short term.
Yeah, I agree with you. In long term, over the long run, we've got DNA. We've got we have democracy burned into our DNA. It's part of us.
This defies humanity, if you will. It defies it.
Well, it defies democracy.
Well,
and
sure.
that is where it is so criminal. In the next hour, I'm going to play a clip of General Michael Hayden, the former director of the NSA, talking about this.
Yeah.
And right now, I've got a little clip of John Kerry I'm going to play. So, Gary, thanks for calling up and weighing in.
Add one more thing.
Sure.
Thank you. The financial landscape, as you know, has changed so dramatically. Our culture. We need to elect somebody, obviously, that's going to energize. And I'm not going to get the names here. Energize the middle, little left, little right. And if we don't, and I want you to, well, I'm going to hang up, and I want you to espouse on this, you will. If we do not start quickly to make a dent in some of these major areas of concern in our country, I submit there won't be any country left.
Well, I think we are at a crossroads. We are at a very dangerous point, Gary, and thank you for sharing that, and I agree with you. And I think that the problem is that in the Democratic Party there is this belief that it has to be a little left, a little right, a little flag-burning amendment from Hillary, a little, you know, and that's not really where the majority of the country is at. The majority of the country, you look at the polls, more than half of Americans think gays should be allowed to live and let live, and marry or not, it doesn't matter. More than half of Americans. More than half of Americans believe abortion should be safe and legal. More than half of Americans believe, over 80% of Americans believe we should have national health insurance. More than, you know, solidly more than half of Americans think that, you know, Social Security should be made stable and safe, even if all of these things require increasing the taxes. In fact, more than half of Americans support rolling back George W. Bush's tax cuts for the rich, for the millionaires and billionaires, and his tax cut on dividend income. And so what the Democrats have to figure out is when they say a little for the left, a little for the right, let's be in the middle, they got to figure out where the middle is, because they're all calling the middle the left. And it ain't the left. I'm sorry. It's the middle.
It is a violation of law, and we don't disagree with him at all. And this is exactly what Karl Rove does.
This is John Kerry, by the way, talking about Karl Rove and the NSA and all this stuff.
Laden is going to die of kidney failure before he's killed by Karl Rove and his crowd. And all he does is divide America over this issue and exploit it.
The he, by the way, he's referring to is Rove.
And what he's trying to pretend is that somehow Democrats don't want to eavesdrop appropriately to protect the country. That's a lie. We're prepared to eavesdrop wherever and whenever necessary in order to make America safer, but we put a procedure in place to protect the constitutional rights of Americans.
We're prepared to eavesdrop wherever. John Kerry, not the most articulate guy in the world. I did work hard for him to become president of the United States. I believe he was elected president of the United States. I think he'd make a good president of the United States, although I think his time has come and gone. I just have to say, he didn't stand up in Ohio, and I feel burned, and I think a lot of Americans do. But nonetheless, he's out there. He's fighting the good fight. He's saying, and basically he's saying, you know, Rove is wrong on the whole NSA thing. And I got to tell you, we're going to get into that in more detail after the news at the top of the hour. This is big. This is Watergate all over again, and it's going to get worse as time goes on. And when you got the President of the United States out in a public venue saying, I'm not a crook, which is what George W. Bush was saying, and Gonzalez, the Attorney General, and a third of the audience stands up and turns their back on it, this administration has a problem. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The place where being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman radio program. George W. Bush yesterday in front of a hand-picked audience. Being asked a few semi-softball questions. Remember back a few months ago, when Neil Horsley, the guy who runs the anti-abortion websites, you know, where they put the abortion doctors' pictures up, and when they get killed, they put an X through them. You know, it's like, and they have maps to their homes and things, so you too can kill an abortion doctor, or, you know, somebody who works in an abortion clinic. Neil Horsley is that guy. And Alan Colmes interviewed him and said, you know, what's life like on the farm or on the ranch there? And Horsley, you know, had some thoughts on it. Well, we took a little bit of audio from George W. Bush yesterday and a little bit of audio from Alan's show, a little bit of his interview with Neil Horsley, and just thought it made a beautiful juxtaposition.
You're a rancher. A lot of us here in Kansas are ranchers. I was just wanting to get your opinion on Brokeback Mountain, if you'd seen it yet. You would love it. You should check it out.
I hadn't seen it. I'd be glad to talk about ranching, but I haven't seen the movie. I heard about it. I hope you go, you know, I hope you go back to the ranch and the farm is what I was about to say.
Yeah, we know what happens there, right?
I hadn't seen it.
You are known for your anti-abortion and anti-homosexual views. You have sex with animals?
When you grow up on a farm in Georgia, your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that is so.
You didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia. Did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
I'm saying that it has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from the...
Look, I'll admit, Neil, I'm a city boy. I don't know a lot about growing up on a farm.
Well, welcome to domestic life on the farm.
But I think for you to say...
Welcome to domestic...
There are a lot of people listening to you right... Neil, there are a lot of people listening to me right now who live on farms, are raising kids on farms, who grew up on farms, and I don't think they're dating Elsie right now. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, don't know that in fact you.
Well, anyhow, we'll just leave it right there. Every now and then you try these things out, see how they work. General Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA. This is mind-boggling. This is absolutely mind-boggling. You know, to turn serious for a moment here. Now, first of all, let me share with you the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution in its entirety. It's only one sentence. The entire amendment is one sentence. And this is the Privacy Amendment, right? Although back in 1789, when this thing was added to the Constitution, they didn't use the word privacy because it was a euphemism for toilet functions back then. You said, I need some privacy. That was a way of saying I need to, you know, use the restroom because, it wasn't until... popular lore has it anyway. I know that there's, you know, you can, maybe it's an urban legend, but whatever, that it wasn't until the 1800s that Thomas Crapper came along and if not invented, at least popularized and marketed the flush toilet. So before that, it was referred to as the privy and privacy. So you wouldn't use the word privacy. None of the founders ever used the word privacy because it meant toilet functions. But in any case, the Fourth Amendment, the Privacy Amendment, says, and I quote, in one sentence, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Now, that's like pretty much everything, right? Against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause. In other words, only with probable cause can you violate the person's right to be secure in their person, house, or papers, or effects. but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, you have to have a warrant, and that warrant has to have some specific information. There has to be some specific background that tells you that you have probable cause to believe a crime is being committed before you can invade somebody's privacy. It's that simple. You must have probable cause. Now, here, yesterday, as part of the roadshow, the Bush administration roadshow, to convince us that spying on Americans without probable cause, without a warrant, is just fine, thank you very much, the former director of the NSA, the guy who was in charge of the NSA in 2001, back before 9/11, when George W. Bush first started spying on Americans without wiretaps. And we still don't know if, you know, who he was spying on, and whether it was political folks or talk show hosts or who. In any case, the guy who was in charge of the NSA back then, being interviewed yesterday after he's doing this dog and pony show, saying, oh, it's just fine, thank you very much. Just remember, shall not be violated and no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause. Fourth Amendment.
Jonathan Landay with Knight Ridder. I'd like to stay on the same issue, and that is has to do with the standard by which you use to target your wiretaps. I'm no lawyer, but my understanding is that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution specifies that you must have probable cause to be able to do a search that does not violate an American's right against unlawful searches and seizures.
Actually, the Fourth Amendment actually protects all of us against unreasonable search and seizure.
Now, this is General Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA, the guy in charge of spying on us under George W. Bush.
But that's what it says.
The measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable?
The
legal standard is probable cause. General, you used the terms just a few minutes ago, we reasonably believe. And a FISA court, my understanding is, would not give you a warrant if you went before them and say, we reasonably believe. You have to go to the FISA court, or the Attorney General has to go to the FISA court and say, we have probable cause. And so what many people believe, and I'd like you to respond to this, is that what you've actually done is crafted a detour around the FISA court by creating a new standard of reasonably believe in place of probable cause, because the FISA court will not give you a warrant based on reasonable belief. You have to show probable cause. Could you respond to that, please?
Sure. I didn't craft the authorization. I am responding to a lawful order. Right? The Attorney General has averred to the lawfulness of the order.
In other words, he starts out by saying, ain't my fault, I was just doing what I was told. I was ordered to do this by the Attorney General. Then he continues.
But does it not say probable?
The
court standard, the legal standard.
Let's go back to where we were.
Just to be very clear, okay, and believe me, if there's any amendment to the Constitution that employees of the National Security Agency are familiar with, it's the Fourth. Right? And it is a reasonableness standard in the Fourth Amendment. And so what you've raised to me, and I'm not a lawyer and don't want to become one, but what you've raised to me is, in terms of quoting the Fourth Amendment, is an issue of the Constitution. The constitutional standard is reasonable, and we believe, I am convinced, that we're lawful because what it is we're doing is reasonable.
You get that? This guy doesn't even understand what the Fourth Amendment says. Just listen to him say, no, it's not probable cause. It's reasonable. Here, it's just a little exchange here.
But does it not say probable?
No.
The court standard, the legal... But does it not say probable? The court standard, the legal standard,
search and seizure.
The legal standard.
Yeah, see, this is scary that General Michael Hayden, the former director of the NSA, does not know that the Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches. There's that unreasonable word. He thinks that that's the whole thing. Against unreasonable searches. The right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. You must have probable cause.
But does it not say probable?
The
court standard, the legal standard,
search and seizure.
The legal standard is probable cause, General.
And our plucky reporter here what's his name?
Jonathan Landay with Knight Ridder.
There you go, Jonathan Landay with Knight Ridder. Well done, Jonathan, I got to say. And this is chilling. This is chilling. You've got this administration out there saying, you know, we've got all this figured out. You know, it's got nothing to do with this. Bush is at this legal forum, right? They're reinventing the term. They're saying it's not domestic spying. It's terrorist surveillance. Well, who's a terrorist? John Kerry? Is that who you're spying on that you don't want to go before a court for? Bush's remarks, writes the Jennifer Lovin in the Associated Press, were part of an administration campaign to defend the four-year-old program as a crucial and legal terror-fighting tool. The White House is trying to tell its side of the story before the Senate Judiciary Committee opens hearings on it in 2 weeks. Trying to get out ahead of this thing. And it's the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee who are calling for the hearings because they won't let Democrats do it. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Time for our... sometimes you think you know what you know, and sometimes you know you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't even know what you don't know that you need to know, and sometimes you need to know what you don't know that you know. And
you know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be, as Jeffrey Lean, the environment editor at The Independent, notes, if your suntan oil can change the sex of fish, what can it do to you? Yeah, seriously. Scientists have found that the male hornyhead turbo and English sole, these are a couple of fish, feeding near sewage outfalls on the California coast, are being feminized. And a chemical found in sunscreen is the likely culprit. Meanwhile, Swiss researchers have found other suspected gender bender chemicals from sun creams and oils building up in fish in their rivers. Scientists at the University of California Riverside found that two-thirds of the male turbo and sole near a sewage outfall 3 miles off the surfer's paradise of Huntington Beach near Los Angeles were growing ovary tissue in their testes. A similar study at Southern California Coastal Water Research Project found fish affected all along the coast. The American researcher is the first to find sex changes in fish in the open ocean. University of California scientists found that the only culprit they could, quote, exclusively identify, end quote, is oxybenzone. What is oxybenzone? It's the active ingredient in most suntan oils. It's used to protect the skin from ultraviolet light. Oxybenzone, which mimics estrogen's chemical makeup, is washed off tanned bodies in the shower, passes through sewage works unchanged, and settles on the seabed or bottom, feeding fish eat it. The new Swiss research shows two other suspected gender bender substances used in sunscreen and lip balm, octocrylene and 4-methylbenzylidine camphor, also building up alarmingly in fish. They fear that people are being exposed to the chemicals several times over, first by putting them on their skin, and then injecting them into drinking water, and then in the fish they eat. The cosmetics industry denies the chemicals are dangerous and says sunscreen phobia could cause more cancers than this stuff. For unlike other cosmetics, sunscreens unquestionably save lives. Just in Great Britain alone, 100,000 new cases of skin cancer a year are diagnosed, 7,300 potentially deadly melanomas, kill over 1,600 people a year. That's just in the UK. There are other concerns about potential health effects. Some clear sunscreens use nanoparticles, particles so small that they can penetrate the skin and even get into the brain. There's also concern about the universal use of sunscreens. By shielding ourselves from sunlight, we produce less vitamin D, which protects us against as many as 16 different cancers. So, you remember when Ronald Reagan was asked, what are you going to do about the loss of the ozone layer that's increasing the toxicity of sunlight? That sunlight is becoming more dangerous. It's more likely to cause cancer, and not just stimulate the production of vitamin D. And Ronald Reagan's answer was, well, people will have to wear hats and use umbrellas. Well, people are choosing not to. Instead, they're putting sunscreens on, and these sunscreens are changing the makeup of fish. Amazing. By the way, the United States Senate voted, straight party line vote, right down the line, 10 to 8, to pass Sam Alito out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the 10 Republicans saying yes, the 8 Democrats saying no. As the Associated Press notes, in previous judicial battles, a 10 to 8 party line vote would be the first sign of the possibility of a Democratic-led filibuster. And then, for reasons that I don't understand, Jesse Holland, who wrote this article for the Associated Press, said, but Democrats are not expected to try one with Alito, a former federal prosecutor and lawyer for the Reagan administration. Why not? Now is the time to call every single Democratic senator and say, a no vote is not enough. There must be a filibuster on this candidate, on this guy. And the toll-free telephone number, of course, for Congress, 888-355-3588 or 888-818-6641. That's 888-818-6641. Or if you've got free long distance and you want to call the direct line straight in, right into the switchboard, 202-225-3121. We'll get you in there. Because now is the time. It's not going to get any easier. In all probability, the Senate is going to vote on this thing next week, the whole Senate. It's unlikely, given that the Republicans control the Senate and the way that Bill Frist runs the Senate, it's unlikely there's going to be any meaningful debate on this on the Senate floor. And it's time, if the Democrats in the United States Senate won't get a spine, it's time for we the people to give them a spine transplant. And time to call our senators' offices and say, you know, respectfully, sir or madam, get a spine. Filibuster Alito. Come on, it's not that hard. You know, all you have to do is just stand up and say, you know, Mr. Speaker, I declare a filibuster or whatever the magic words are, right? You don't have to take off your clothes. You don't have to, you know, ingest weird substances. You don't have to stand on your head. There's nothing, you know, socially inappropriate about it. Republicans are, you know, when they were in the minority, they're very good at it. The world's record for a filibuster is Strom Thurmond. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. Colin McKenzie is with us. Strange happenings in Canada yesterday. Colin McKenzie, the managing director of news at the Globe and Mail, one of the major newspapers of Canada. Colin, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very pleased to have you on. Paul Martin has stepped down or is stepping down. Stephen Harper, the conservative candidate, has won in Canada.
And then it gets a heck of a lot more complicated.
Fill us in on this.
Okay, so Paul Martin is a guy who's been around since 1988 in our federal political scene, was a very effective minister of finance, quite a controversial one, cutting a lot of social programs in order to pay off a deficit that was far worse than even you guys are looking at now, which is seriously bad. They did fix that over the course of 10 years on the backs of some pretty painful cuts. Inherited the prime ministership about 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago. High expectations, almost Clinton-esque expectations, if you can think back to 92.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of fumbled around, sort of a combination of bad luck, hubris, all the rest. against the backdrop of a government that was, in effect, 12 years old, ran a terrible election campaign, was beaten narrowly by Stephen Harper, an Alberta conservative, again, a policy wonk-ish guy. He's 46. He's kind of young, but he's a young fogey, a libertarian kind of right-winger who comes from a party that, that has a social conservative streak, but he's not one of them.
Is he not one of them, or is he not speaking?
He is not one of them. That's not his instinct. And we can get into outcomes in a minute.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, that's the backdrop.
That's kind of the overview.
The problem is that in winning, we have, under the new Westminster parliamentary system, we've got four political parties in the House of Commons.
And the fourth party, the most liberal of the parties, actually saw more than a 200% increase in the number of seats they have, although it was a small number to begin with.
Well, actually, not that big. It was only 18 to 30, which gets them up to about 10% of a 308-person chamber that we call the House of Commons.
Okay.
So, I don't think there was a happy party leader last night. Harper thought he was going to win enough seats to have a majority, but
the conservative.
Yeah, but he only has a minority government. He's got 122 seats to the Liberals' 105. That's Martin's party.
Mm-hmm.
The New Democrats, the Social Democratic Party up here, has 30 seats, and there are 50 seats that belong to this outfit called the Bloc Québécois, which runs only in the province of Quebec, and their single issue is sovereignty. They want, they're the guys who want to leave the country. So Harper is 30-odd votes short of being able to pass legislation with his own supporters, so he's got to do deals with people to make stuff happen.
Now, the way this is being spun, we're speaking with Colin McKenzie. He's the managing director of news at the Globe and Mail, the newspaper, Canadian newspaper, and the way this is being spun in the United States by some in the news media is that Canada, sort of like America, is figuring out that the best way to be is conservative, and that it's just, you know, contagious wisdom moving north.
Well,
I don't. It doesn't seem that way to me. But
nor to me. I mean, now. A whole bunch of the things about for which we're famous down there, decriminalization of marijuana, same sex, that sort of stuff, in the former case is not going to happen, probably, although what enforcement actually looks like is de facto, I mean, we send grow-up operators to jail, but simple possession is sort of a ticket.
So
sort of stuff's not going to happen.
I have a quick question for you, Colin McKenzie, before we go any further. Is the vote in Canada done entirely on paper, or are there provinces or other areas where there are voting machines?
We do pencils and X's, and it works just fine.
Nationwide. Pencils and X's.
Yeah. Some provinces and some municipal votes have gone to electronic versions, but the federal vote is very old-fashioned.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Back where you were.
Yeah.
And I think it would work for us, too. Gee, what a novel idea.
Yeah. Harper is not a right winger the way you guys understand right wingers. Abortion is unlikely to come up in a Harper government for a number of reasons. Even though he probably believes in some restrictions, but same sex, this parliament is not going to
same sex marriage.
Is not going to overturn the same sex law. Even though the party's position is that there should be a free vote, Harper says that when the courts overrule that vote, because constitutionally it's discrimination, and that's a settled legal issue, no matter what Parliament might say, he wouldn't invoke Parliament's right to overrule the court.
Now, what about the foreign policy issues?
This is the other thing
that's being talked about down here, is that this guy, Stephen Harper, is going to be a good buddy with George W. They're going to be out drinking beer together and figuring out who they're going to blow up next.
I think Harper probably hopes all of that happens, except maybe the last thing. He's a national Canadian politician. He can't cuddle. on the one hand. Things are going to be better, if only, because Martin's guys are gone, and they, in their desperation to hang on to power, were sticking the thumb in the White House's eye every time they could, they got a chance.
So they were kind of pandering to an anti-American vote in Canada.
Absolutely they were. It was shameless and really not very edifying. You know, no matter what you think of the policies of the current incumbent, you don't you don't kick them around like that, especially when you guys are so important to us. But
yeah. Well, actually, I kick them around for a living here on this radio program, but I'm not a politician. I'm not trying to lead a country.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you also have to differentiate between the United States and this administration. I mean,
yes.
We're sitting in a different place than you guys. I mean, I can completely understand how unhappy the last little while must have been for you folks, even as it gives you a multitude of targets to rail at.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, and I would say the vast majority of Americans. I mean, we do polls here in the United States, and we find that, you know, more than 80% of Americans want national health care. We can't get it. The majority of Americans would like, you know, clean air and clean water and strong protections. We can't get it. The majority of Americans would like Bush's tax cuts for the rich rolled back and a balanced budget. Ain't going to happen. I mean, you just go right on down the list. The majority of Americans are not where George W. Bush is, and yet there he is.
Well, yeah, but the clock is ticking, eh? So we're not going to see that. We will see a friendlier tone, but we're not going to be sending folks to Iraq. We have been fairly heavily involved in Afghanistan, and that'll probably continue. We've got about to have 2,000 guys actually sort of going out and chasing Taliban instead of doing the usual Canadian peacekeeping thing in a month or so.
But there's probably a pretty broad consensus about chasing Taliban as opposed to getting into Iraq.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no, you know, we're very happy to be election observers and to do democracy building once there's an Iraqi regime that you can deal with. But
We're speaking with Colin McKenzie. He's the managing director of news at the Globe and Mail, the Canadian newspaper. And Colin, we have about 2 minutes left. I'm wondering what this means for the future of Canada. Again, the spinmeisters here in the United States are saying this means Canada is going to begin moving in a very conservative direction. They're going to get more and more conservative as time goes on. You're going to see privatization of their health insurance, of your health insurance programs. And by the way, they all say that you guys have to stand in line for years and years to get surgery and things. Is it really that bad there?
Our healthcare system has challenges, and I think Harper's election is part of an emerging consensus that the old model, whereby everything is public, all hospitals are publicly owned, it may not be the only answer. That there may be a room for to respond to things like waiting lists, which can be up to a year for a non-critical hip replacement, that sort of thing.
Right, but a critical condition, you get seen immediately.
Absolutely. I mean, our tertiary care trauma stuff is absolutely first rate. I mean, you know, on a bad Saturday night, you might have to wait in an ER for for a bed to open upstairs from time to time. But the Canadian healthcare system is excellent and provides excellent outcomes, even though there are some issues. So maybe you have some private clinics that do nothing but hip replacements if you've got a big hip replacement problem.
Yeah.
That kind of thing is going to provoke some debate up here because that's not a consensus yet, but that's the extent of the end of the healthcare of where healthcare is going. Harper is very explicit that he believes in a public healthcare system.
So it almost sounds like, you know, Stephen Harper, while he's called a conservative in Canada, would in the United States be called a centrist Democrat.
Yeah, he not much wiggle room between he and Joe Lieberman, as a for instance,
or maybe even Joe Biden,
or even Joe Biden. Although Joe Biden is actually a little bit of a welfare state guy, right? And this guy is
Stephen Harper is not. Okay.
Anyway,
we appreciate the overview. I'm sorry we've run out of time here, but I really very very much appreciate the overview and thank you for sharing with us. Colin McKenzie, the managing director of news at the Globe and Mail, Canadian newspaper, and globeandmail.com, of course, the website if you want to read the paper. Colin, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Not a problem. Nice to talk.
Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Two microphone promo America. Discover the power of web conferencing with GoToMeeting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, the time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing, like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. Craig in Boone, North Carolina. Hey, Craig, welcome to the program.
Tom, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for waiting.
You put on an excellent, highly informative show, and I thank you for it, and I thank you for your published work.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Do you have 1 minute for me to share a couple of things, then I'll get off and listen to the response?
Well, yeah, if it's 1 minute.
Okay, here we are. It's regarding the Fourth Amendment domestic NSA surveillance program.
Yeah.
This is so far beyond, in my view, right and left-wing politics. It's beyond the Bush administration. And it's a potent threat to this republic and has been since the early 80s. To talk about this, sometimes you get marginalized as crazy, but this is really about clear listening and deep thinking. The facts are really that the NSA is probably about 5 to 10 years ahead of what the public is even aware of in terms of technology. Since about the 80s, they've been able to read all domestic faxes, telegrams, emails, and they can listen to any phone call, including this one.
Right, although my understanding is that by law, the NSA was doing international intelligence and the FBI was doing domestic intelligence. Am I missing something?
I'm just going to quickly go to, you had James Bamford on your program.
Right.
Two sources, that's for starters. There's an expert,
I've read The Puzzle Palace.
Yeah, and the later one's even more informative. Also, may I suggest the History Channel has a DVD out on the Echelon program.
Oh, interesting.
So what I want to say really quickly is this is about deep and clear thinking, and if you read between the lines, it's what we don't know. It's what Mr. Bamford doesn't know.
Yeah.
And if you listen...
As Don Rumsfeld said, and it's what you don't know that will get you.
Who knows?
There you go.
Well, and if you listen to General Hayden's remarks and everybody in the Bush regime, they are simply not telling the truth. Quick point. Did you catch? He told us how many hours of domestic phone calls were made in 2005. Think about that.
You mean, as in, how did they know that?
Yeah, correct.
Right, unless they were scanning them. Yeah.
They have technology. The potential is there. They can do it. No matter if they do it or not. And on the DVD History Channel, there was a surveillance intelligence person from Canada, and he said, that's easy. They get around your Fourth Amendment. They ask us to do it.
Yeah, the ultimate, or they privatize it. They send it to a private corporation.
That's right.
And that's being done increasingly. So the question, Craig, is what do we do about it?
Well, the only thing I can tell is I just wanted to come and share. If people are aware that it's there.
That's the key. What we need to be doing is we need to be raising consciousness about this issue. And Craig, thank you very much for the call. I got to move along because we're just about out of time here. But we need to be raising consciousness about this. And what is privacy? I mean, so many Americans are saying, okay, I'll go along with it. Mike in Pebble Beach, California. I don't think we should go along with it. What's up, Mike?
Hello?
Hey, Mike, you're live and on the air.
Okay. Unfortunately, we may not have enough time, but I wanted to suggest in connection with your urging people to call their senators that they should also call in neighboring red Republican states and red Democrat senators to filibuster, to worry,
absolutely.
Pardon?
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you.
Now, they have all, including the administration officials, but all of the senators and representatives have sworn an oath to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States, not people.
That's right. And when George Bush says, "I'm, you know, my job here is to protect the people," no, I'm sorry. Your job, as in your oath of office, which is in Article 2 of the Constitution, your oath of office is to defend the Constitution. In fact, it's quite explicit. You know,
and on the privacy issue, that applies with even more force, I think, in terms of logic.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I'm reading from the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Paragraph 8. Before he shall enter on the execution of the office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. Quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Period. Close quote. End of paragraph. It says nothing in there about being daddy.
I think a good strategy for radical liberals is to...
You mean normal people?
Raise the thought in the minds of these guys who are not doing their job and not living up to their oath. We're going to accuse them of failing to live up their oath in the next election.
There you go. Absolutely, Mike. Absolutely. You're spot on. We just got 1 minute left. Bob in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I have a way, I think, to defeat Alito without filibustering. It depends on the answer to how many senators are needed to defeat a Clotcher motion. I believe it said the Senate rules say 3/5 of the number of senators voting.
I don't know. I don't know the Senate rules that well. I'm sorry.
If that is the case, if the Democratic 7 senators of the Gang of 14...
Isn't invoking cloture and breaking a filibuster the same thing, or am I missing something here?
Well, no, they just are not voting for cloture, and then the Republicans would need 56 votes of the remaining 93 senators, and if Reid holds those remaining Democrats together, Frist can't invoke.
Oh, that's the thing. I mean, Bob, there is no doubt in my mind. The Democrats, you know, there's enough strength in the Democratic Party, and there's enough Democrats who are going to vote no on this thing, that if the guys who voted no, the men and women who voted no on this, also filibustered it, Alito's out on his butt. And the Constitution is intact, and we can all, you know, take a deep breath and, you know, wait for Bush to send us another crackpot and start the cycle all over again. And it's fine. If you have to fight a battle 50 times, you keep fighting it over and over and over again. Because we're fighting for the United States of America here. We're fighting for the country we love. We're fighting for something that people have fought and died for almost 230 years now. And it's worth fighting for. It really is. It's certainly worth making a call to your senator for it. We'll see you tomorrow. Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag, you're in.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.